but because she wore skirts, she was referred to by some as a real bitch. Jones knew this and didn't let it bother her. As gatekeeper to the president, it worked to her advantage. Every day she received dozens of requests for the president's time. If she were patient and nice with everyone that called, those requests would double within a week. The very definition of her job required that she be blunt and firm. Not enough time, not enough energy.
"Valerie, you have to have some idea who in the hell that was."
Hayes watched her for a response. He got none and expanded his questioning.
"What did Russ tell you?"
Hayes asked, referring to the chairman of the Democratic National Committee.
"He said the man was a wealthy Arab prince who wanted to make a donation to the DNC.
"A foreigner making a donation to the DNC?
Hayes shook his head in anger.
"Russ said it would all be legit."
Hayes frowned.
"I thought I told all of you people no funny stuff. I want everything to be above board."
Hayes kept his voice low, but it was obvious he was angry. Without looking up, Jones replied,
"It was a lot of money, and it was going to be legal."
Hayes almost lost it. This was something he had been adamant about since the day he had decided to run for president. The expression on his face told his chief of staff that the amount of money would not make the transgression any easier to take. Jones realized it had been the wrong thing to say.
"Sorry might not be good enough for this one."
Jones looked up with a fair amount of fright.
"What are you trying to say?"
"Exactly what I said. Sorry might not be good enough. People have died, Val, and there are a lot of questions that are going to have to be answered."
President Hayes stared at her, making sure she truly understood the gravity of the situation. Across the bunker near the door, Special Agent Jack Warch was sitting on his bunk sprawled against the cool concrete wall. The usually rigid Warch had removed his tie and jacket, both of which were neatly folded next to him on the hinged Navy-style bunk. The 30-by-20-foot room had 18 sturdy bunks. Two sets of four, one lower and one upper, were bolted along each of the long walls, and two more on the wall by the door. The bunks were of the no-frills military style. One side of the bed was attached to the wall by two hinges, and the outer corners were attached to a 3-foot chain that was bolted to the wall. When not being used, the bunks could be swung up and out of the way. The floor and the first 4 feet of the wall were covered by the same plain brown carpet that adorned the floor and walls of the evacuation tunnel. At the opposite end of the bunker, there was a small bathroom and kitchenette. In the middle of the room was a square arrangement of two couches and two love seats, all four made of brown vinyl trying to disguise itself as leather. The seamless ceiling and walls were painted an off-white that helped to soften just slightly the room's bleak appearance. The special agent in charge of the presidential detail reached out and picked up his black Motorola encrypted radio. His flesh-toned earpiece and hand mic lay uselessly coiled on the bunk's pillow. Not more than 10 minutes after they made it into the bunker, the expensive little radio had dropped code, the Secret Service's euphemism for the radio not working. It was not just Warch's radio. All 10 agents had looked at each other at the exact same moment, knowing instantly that they were cut off. The terrorists had gotten to the digital encryption system and crashed it, taking all of the radios offline. Warch had switched to his digital phone, and for 5 minutes he tried frantically to reestablish contact with the Secret Service's Joint Operations Command. The phone was working, but they weren't answering. Then the line went dead. They were completely cut off from the outside and could only assume the worst. If the Secret Service had fended off the attack, they would not still be sitting in the bunker. With or without communications, his people knew the codes and could simply come and open the door. The worst had to be assumed. They had lost the White House. Warch looked across the bunker at a disheveled President Hayes and his chief of staff. They were sitting on one of the couches talking in whispers. It was time to tell him the truth. Chapter 11. After Aziz's electrifying phone call, chaos had once again broken out in the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs briefing room. To Mitch Rapp's left, his bosses were conferring with the Joint Chiefs, and to his right, Vice President Baxter was holding court with the cabinet. Rapp, having a fairly good idea how most of the people to his left would handle the situation, decided to focus his listening on the politicians to his right. After several minutes, Rapp concluded that no one in Baxter's group knew their head from their ass, and in the process of coming to this conclusion, he also discovered a correlation between their opinions and the conviction with which they stated them. It seemed that the less someone knew, the more forcefully he tried to state his case. Words like caution and prudence crept into every sentence, and every time Rapp heard them uttered, he couldn't help but think that these men and women had no idea whom they were dealing with. On more than one occasion, Rapp fought the urge to interject his frank opinion and correct the neophytes to his right. Twice, he actually started to come out of his seat, but caught himself in time. Kennedy was right. It was best for him to keep a low profile. The fragmented conversations continued for several more minutes, and then Vice President Baxter began snapping his fingers and calling for the group's attention. The discussions trickled to a stop, and then Baxter said, "Attorney General Tutwiler has a plan, and I would like everyone to hear her out." All eyes went from Baxter to the Attorney General as she pulled her chair forward. Tutwiler took off her glasses and held them in both hands. "Treasury Secretary Rose has confirmed that this money does in fact exist, and as most of us know, it was frozen by our government when the Shah was overthrown. There is a case to be made that this money is not ours." Tutwiler set her glasses down and centered them on her leather briefing folder. "I strongly believe that as a sign of good faith and willingness to negotiate for the hostages, we should release part of the money at 9 tomorrow, and in return, we will ask Mr. Aziz to show his good faith and release some of the hostages." In unison, her end of the table turned to see how the idea would be received by the other end, which was anchored by the representatives from the Joint Chiefs, the CIA, and the FBI. Admiral Nelson, the Chief of Naval Operations, was the first to speak. With his bald head and gaunt face, Nelson said, "I would advise against giving them anything. It will set a horrible precedent. Our policy on terrorism has always been zero tolerance and no negotiation. Zero." Nelson brought his hand up and formed the number with his thumb and fingers. "The entire world is watching. Now is not the time to reverse our course." Vice President Baxter looked at his military advisers. He had known this would be their position, but now he needed them on board. He needed to build some consensus. That way, if everything blew up, he wouldn't be the only one holding the bag. Baxter decided to play up the compassion factor. "Let me remind everyone that we have hostages in there. American citizens. Yes, the president is safe, but we still have to do our best to get our people out of there alive. These are troops we left behind, and if we have to pay a little money that isn't even ours," Baxter looked around the room, nodding his head, "to get some of them out, then that is what we are going to do." The vice president focused his attention on the opposite end of the table, looking each of the military officers in the eye, one at a time. He would call them later, individually, to shore up support where it was needed. After finishing his Dale Carnegie personal eye contact maneuver, the vice president moved on to his conclusion. "In light of the recent events, this is what we are going to do." Baxter pointed at Director Roach of the FBI. "I want you and your people to take charge of the entire area surrounding the White House. If you need to use any of the Secret Service's people in an advisory role, feel free to do so." Director Roach leaned forward. "I assume you would like us to draw up plans for rescuing the hostages?" "Of course, but no action is to be taken unless I say so. If we have to go in, I want to have secured the release of as many hostages as possible beforehand." Baxter then turned to Attorney General Tutwiler and said, "Marge, please fill us in on how things will proceed tomorrow." Tutwiler inclined her head forward so she could see all the way down the table.
At 9 tomorrow, we will call Mr. Aziz and inform him that we are prepared to transfer part of the money into his accounts. This will be fairly easy to do. Secretary Rose tells me the money is in a dozen separate banks, so we will simply transfer the proper amount of money from one of the banks to Iran. The sum will be around $1 billion. We will tell him we are working on getting the rest of the money, but it would help if, in a sign of good faith, he would release some of the hostages.
Tutwiler paused for a moment, distracted by a man halfway down the table who was shaking his head vigorously. Tutwiler started speaking again, but kept her eyes on the man.
I have done quite a bit of research on hostage negotiations, and have found that in these situations, if you can get the captors to acquiesce to even the smallest request, you have significantly increased your chances for freeing the hostages.
Tutwiler stopped speaking as she watched the man shake his head one last time and then drop his face into his hands. The Attorney General was not the only one who noticed. Rapp couldn't take it anymore. Every time Tutwiler uttered a word, he felt as if someone were driving a nail further and further into his temple. As Rapp buried his face in his hands, he said to himself, "This can't be happening. Please tell me this isn't happening. I have put in all of this work, and I'm so close." Rapp squeezed his head in his hands and thought to himself, "This woman has no idea what the fuck she is talking about." At least half of the people at the table were looking back and forth between Marge Tutwiler and the unknown dark-haired man who seemed to be in danger of suffering an aneurysm before their very eyes. That the others were watching also did not go unnoticed by the Attorney General. Tutwiler cleared her throat loudly and asked,
"Excuse me, is everything all right?"
Rapp didn't hear her at first, and then he felt Irene Kennedy touch his arm. Slowly, Rapp let his hands fall from his face and looked up to find the attention of everyone at the table on him. When Tutwiler repeated her question, Rapp looked at her and said, "I'm sorry, I didn't hear you." In an extremely impatient tone, the Attorney General asked,
"Is there something you would like to add, or should we get you some aspirin for your headache?"
Rapp turned briefly to his bosses, who gave him no signal one way or another, and then directed his attention back to the Attorney General. As he registered the condescending expression on her face, something told him now was not the time to be meek. This was it. For the first time in this shitty journey, he knew where Rafiq Aziz was and where he would be for the immediate future. Cover or no cover, there was a good chance this was going to be the last battle, and there was no sense in going home with a lot of unused ammo. Rapp straightened himself and said, "I would most definitely like to add something. Actually, I would like to add a lot." He paused briefly and then said, "First of all, if you only give him part of the money and ask him to release some of the hostages, he will blow his screwy lid. He will take one or more of the hostages right to the window so all of the cameras can watch, and he will kill them. He will blow their heads off on national TV." Tutwiler threw her head back and with a disapproving look said,
"Is that right, Mr.
Cruz?
And what exactly is your expertise in regards to negotiating with terrorists, Mr. Cruz?"
Rapp found the question so ridiculous he shook his head and laughingly replied, "None." Tutwiler, not used to being treated in such a manner, turned to Baxter and said in a loud enough voice for half of the room to hear,
"What is this man doing here?"
Her arrogant question drove Rapp up and out of his chair with Irene Kennedy's hand gripping at his forearm. Rapp pried his boss's fingers loose, saying firmly, "I've put way too much into this." Rapp began walking toward the podium. His suit, white shirt, and tie did a decent job of helping him blend in, but to anyone who cared to notice, it wasn't hard to figure out he was more than an analyst. When Rapp reached the podium, he repeated Tutwiler's question to the group. "What is this man doing here?" Rapp stared up at the ceiling as if mulling the question over. "You know, I've asked myself that question a lot of times over the last decade, and I'm afraid I can't answer it for you." Rapp turned back toward Tutwiler, a look of feigned wonderment on his face. But I can answer your other question, the one about negotiating with terrorists. Rapp paused, and then said casually, I don't negotiate with terrorists, Ms. Tutwiler. I kill them. Grabbing the podium, Rapp looked down the length of the table and said, I hunt them down, and I kill them. Tutwiler sat up a little straighter, attempting to appear unfazed by the unusual admission. Trying to gain some composure, she asked the first question that came to mind. Who do you work for, Mr. Cruz? I'm afraid that's on a need-to-know basis, ma'am. With his smart-ass grin, Rapp gave the standard spycraft reply, And you don't need to know.
Well, Mr. Cruz, if we decide it's time to kill these terrorists, said Tutwiler, repeating his words in a mocking tone, we will make sure we give you a call. Until then, we would all appreciate it if you would take a seat so we can get on with the business at hand.
Tutwiler's smugness was really starting to irk Rapp, and his temper was dangerously close to reaching a level that he couldn't control. He studied her for a second, and then asked, Ms. Tutwiler, have you ever been to Beirut? Rapp waited a moment for her response, and then said, I didn't think so. Just in case you were wondering, that's where Rafik Aziz is from. How about Iran? Have you ever been there? Rapp gave her less than a second to answer. I didn't think so. I was in Iran last night, Rapp added casually. Actually, I spent most of the last week there. And since we don't have an embassy in Iran, you can probably figure out that I wasn't on official government business. Do you by any chance speak Farsi or any Arabic dialects? Rapp shook his head, answering the question for her. I didn't think so. How about the Muslim faith, the jihad? Are you up to speed on the customs of Rafik Aziz and his people?
What's your point, Mr. Cruz? Asked a defiant Tutwiler.
Rapp looked down the long table at the smug attorney general and growled in a voice that was barely beneath a shout, The point is, Ms. Tutwiler, you don't have the slightest clue who you're dealing with. Rapp pointed at her with each word. While you were running around on the talk show circuit criticizing law enforcement officers who have done more in 1 week to stop crime than you will do in your entire academic theory-laden lifetime, I was crawling around in the gutter of every hellhole in the Middle East trying to find Rafik Aziz. Rapp watched Tutwiler fold her arms tightly across her chest and roll her eyes. The last gesture did it, and in a voice intended to shake up more than just the attorney general, he yelled, Hey, lady, this isn't a game. This isn't about who has the most master's degrees or the biggest job title. People have died, and before this thing is over, more people are going to die. Rapp turned his face to the side, showing the pinkish mark that angled downward across his bronzed face. Do you see this scar? Let me clue you in on a little secret. It isn't a paper cut. It was given to me in person by none other than Rafik Aziz. So when I offer my opinion about a man who you have never met, who you know nothing about, you should sit up and listen. Rapp tightly gripped both sides of the podium. The man we are talking about here isn't a bank robber, and he sure as hell isn't some hack like David Koresh. He's a religious zealot who also happens to be a very highly trained and intelligent killer. Your little plan for tomorrow might stand a chance if we were dealing with some pissed off employee who had taken over a bank or a post office, but this is the big leagues. Rapp zeroed in on Tutwiler. Aziz isn't some two-bit criminal. When you jerk his chain tomorrow, by only giving him part of what he's asked for, he's going to take a bite out of your ass, and he's going to bite hard. Rapp leaned forward, elbows bent, poised over the podium, looking for even the smallest sign that he was getting through to the politicians at the other end of the room. The expressions on their faces said it all. Everything he said was falling on deaf ears. The men and women at the opposite end of the table were looking at him as if he were speaking a foreign language. Rapp couldn't believe it. Rafik Aziz was his cause. It had become his personal crusade. He'd devoted a full third of his life to hunting this one man, and that was only the start. It had grown to be much more than that as the death toll mounted. It had turned into a race to stop him from killing again. There was no one in this room, and probably no one in the world who understood the mind of Rafik Aziz better than Rapp. And after all that he had given, how was he being repaid at the exact moment when they should be listening to him most? He was being regarded as if he were some crazed idiot. Rapp bit down hard on his tongue and fought back the urge to scream at the top of his lungs. At that moment, he realized he had one course of action. If the smug Marge Tutwiler wanted to put her little theories to work, and these idiots wanted to follow her, then so be it. Tutwiler had given herself more than enough rope to hang herself with, and Rapp knew that as sure as the sun would rise tomorrow, she would be swinging from the gallows in the morning. Rapp shook his head and said, "I've given you fair warning." As he started for the exit, he yelled over his shoulder, "Call me after you're done playing games, and I'll come in and clean up your mess." With that, Rapp opened the door and disappeared into the hallway. General Flood watched Rapp leave the room and then swiveled his chair away from the table, beckoning one of his aides over with a discreet wave of his forefinger. When the general had asked Director Stansfield to bring the young operative, he had not envisioned the scene that had just unfolded, but he was happy somebody had stepped up to the plate. An Air Force captain bent to the general's ear, and Flood whispered, "Please detain Mr. Cruz for me, and have him wait in my office until we're finished." All of the hostages, with the exception of the Secret Service agents, had been moved to the White House mess. The tables and chairs that normally occupied the room had been thrown into the main hallway that led out onto West Executive Drive and now formed a tangled blockade. The hostages were seated on the floor, bunched in a tight circle like corralled cattle. Anywhere from one to four terrorists were watching over them at a time, and they came and went with no apparent pattern, often stopping to kick and scream at the hostages. Anna Reilly was relieved as she sat back down on the blue carpet of the White House mess. She had made it to the bathroom and back without being hit or kicked. The woman in front of her had been slapped for daring to look up at one of the terrorists. Reilly had kept her eyes down with only one exception. One of the terrorists had followed her into the stall and to her complete humiliation had watched her go to the bathroom. Reilly was frightened by the expression on his face. He had stared at her intently while she relieved herself, and when she stood to pull her pants up, his eyes had followed her every move. The thought caused Reilly to clutch the neck of her blouse and shudder. After the World Trade Center bombing, Reilly had done a piece on Islamic terrorism for the NBC affiliate in Chicago. That two-week project had given her enough insight into the minds of radical Islamic fundamentalists to know that they were crazed in a way that was difficult even for the daughter of a Chicago cop to understand. In her captors' minds, women were objects to be owned or discarded, no different than a piece of livestock. Women who were not of the faith were deemed impure and evil, another way of saying fair game. What a first day on the job, he thought to himself. Reilly had wanted to be in the thick of real news, and now she was an actual part of one of the biggest stories in decades. She brushed a strand of her brown hair behind her ear, and with her head tilted toward the ground, she looked up toward one of the guards. The guard turned in her direction, and she quickly averted her eyes. "Don't make eye contact," she told herself. "Look submissive and try to blend in." Anna Reilly was blessed with a healthy sense of street smarts. Having grown up in the heart of Chicago, she had been exposed to the seedier side of life at an early age. Her mother, a social worker, and her father, a Chicago cop, made sure their five sons and only daughter understood that life was much different from what was shown on TV. All of this exposure had given the young woman a very strong survival instinct. Several years earlier in Chicago, it had saved her life, and here in Washington, she was hoping to repeat the performance. Reilly had already removed all of her jewelry and as much of her makeup as possible. She knew that the less attention she attracted to herself, the better. There had already been two men who had had their noses split wide open, and there was another woman who had been slapped so hard on the side of her head that her ear had started to bleed. Really kept repeating to herself, "Just keep a low profile, and you might make it out of here alive." Less could be said for Reilly's new office partner, Stone Alexander, who was sitting at her side. He hadn't wandered more than several feet from her since the onset of the attack. Not that he was protecting her. If anything, it was Reilly who was protecting him. Alexander leaned closer to her and asked, "How long are they going to make us sit here?" Without moving her lips, Reilly whispered, "The only thing I know is, if one of these guys sees you talking, he's going to come over here and crack his rifle over your surgically altered nose. So for the last time, shut up!" Alexander shrank away and dropped his head onto his folded hands. He had already cried twice. Pathetic, Reilly thought to herself. Her father had always said people show their true colors in a crisis, and Alexander had shown his. It was yellow. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw someone new enter the room, and she glanced up at the man, careful to keep her head down. Reilly had not seen this one before. He looked different from the others. He was wearing the same green fatigues, but his hair was well styled, and he lacked any facial hair. Reilly noted that the man was actually quite handsome. That was when it hit her. It was the same man that Russ Piper had introduced her to. A prince somebody or other. Oh my God, Reilly thought. Where is Russ? With her head down, Reilly scanned the mass of people looking for her parents' friend. Piper was nowhere in sight, and she could not remember seeing him since this morning. Reilly scrutinized the man again. This man was the leader. It was obvious by how the others spoke to him and looked at him. When this supposed prince had entered the room, the other three terrorists had done everything short of snapping off salutes. The bald terrorist, who Reilly had originally thought was the leader, entered the room and approached the prince. He began whispering in the leader's ear, and Reilly instantly noticed a change in the prince's eyes. Rafiq Aziz stood with a demeanor that looked to be teetering between confidence and rage. As Muammar Benghazi whispered in his ear, the scales began to tilt in favor of rage. Aziz had known this moment would come. The fact that he had already played it out in his mind 100 times would not take away from his performance. Benghazi finished relaying to his friend the information that had been requested. Without hesitation, Aziz yelled, "Where?" Benghazi pointed to a hostage sitting near the edge of the group and then followed Aziz as he walked briskly toward the man. Aziz stopped 5 feet from a man in a white shirt and loosened tie. Pointing to the man, Aziz asked Benghazi, "Him?" Benghazi nodded. Aziz looked down at the man and commanded, "Stand!" The man did as he was told and rose to a height several inches taller than Aziz. The man looked to be in his early to mid-50s with short brown and gray hair. In a voice loud enough to make sure everyone heard him, Aziz asked, "You have a request?" The man started out somewhat nervously. "We have a pregnant woman in the group, and several other people who are older. I had asked, your man," the White House employee pointed to Benghazi, "if we could get some blankets and food for..." Aziz cut him off with a loud, "No!" The man took a quarter of a step back. "But," he gestured with an open hand to a woman on the floor, "she's pregnant." Aziz looked at the bulging stomach of the woman on the floor. She was lying on her back with her head resting on an older woman's lap. Without taking his eyes off the expectant mother, Aziz slid his right hand to his thigh and found the grip of his gun. He pulled the pistol from his holster and turned to the man standing before him. Without saying a word, without the slightest expression on his face, Aziz raised the gun to the man's forehead and from a distance of 1 foot pulled the trigger. The loud crack of the gunshot caused everyone in the room to jerk involuntarily. Before the report of the gun had died, the man was propelled backward and into the huddled mass of hostages, his blood, brain matter, and skull fragments showering a half-dozen shocked individuals. As the room erupted, Rafiq Aziz turned and marched for the exit. His cold expression masked a perverse satisfaction in completing another chapter in his plan. Aziz left the room to the noise of his men screaming at the hostages. As he walked down the hall to the Situation Room, a smile creased his lips. When the time came, the hostages would give him no trouble. From this point forward, they would be as docile as a flock of lambs. Chapter 12. As the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Flood was the highest-ranking officer in the U.S. military. The size and opulence of his office, located just down the hall from the Joint Chiefs' briefing room, was fitting for a man who wielded such power. The walls were covered with photos and plaques that documented his rise through the ranks of the Army. In typical military fashion, the show was arranged in order, starting in one corner with a photo of a young plebe at West Point, and then documenting his ascension through the ranks until he reached his current and final post. The room was set up in thirds. At the far end was a rectangular conference table that seated 20. In the middle of the room was the general's substantial Thomas Aquinas-style desk. The expansive wood surface curved, so the desk literally wrapped its way around the general's healthy midsection. This allowed Flood to swivel in his chair and go from project to project without having to exert too much effort. The last third of the office was dominated by an assortment of couches and chairs arranged around a long glass coffee table. Mitch Rapp sat in one of the chairs facing the office's entrance. General Flood's aide had escorted him into the room about 30 minutes earlier. Since then, Rapp had been eyeing an expensive bottle of Booker's small batch bourbon that was sitting behind the general's well-stocked wet bar on his right. Rapp was tired and edgy. He hadn't worked out in almost a week, and since he was used to putting in at least 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, his body was rebelling. The sleep he had gotten had been minimal, the food had been awful, and now it had all come down to this. His expertise was being called into question by someone who had been teaching law students for the last decade, while he had been putting his ass on the line. Rapp had never felt such frustration. Aziz was right across the river, sitting in the White House, and there was nothing he could do about it but sit and wait. After another 10 minutes or so, General Flood returned to his office. He was accompanied by Rapp's two bosses and General Campbell, the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. Rapp stood to meet them and tried to get a read from Director Stansfield as to whether he was going to have him taken out and shot. Rapp quickly realized it was a futile effort. Trying to gauge Thomas Stansfield was like trying to read the expression of the Sphinx. The longer you observed, the more you thought you saw. But in reality, you saw nothing. In the case of the Sphinx, it was because there was nothing. But in the case of Thomas Stansfield, there was a lot. General Flood began to undo the gold buttons of his military blouse almost immediately.
"Well, Mr. Cruz, you sure as hell caught a lot of people's attention in there."
Flood pulled his jacket off and threw it over the back of one of the chairs. "I'm sorry if I..." Flood cut him off with a flip of the wrist.
"No need for apologies. It was exactly what they needed."
The general continued for the bar.
"Who needs a drink? I sure as hell do."
Flood turned over a glass tumbler and grabbed a bottle of 25-year-old Macallan single malt scotch. The general poured in 3 fingers' worth and then added a handful of ice. After swirling the cubes around in the glass, he brought the drink to his lips and took a long pull. He closed his eyes and set the drink down, savoring the taste. After a moment of silence, he opened his eyes and exhaled, a look of satisfaction on his face.
"Irene, what would you like?"
Kennedy was not a big drinker, but from past experience she knew that with the general it was not important that you drank your drink. It was just important that you had one in front of you.
"Vodka, please."
Flood knew what Stansfield and Campbell drank and had already begun pouring their drinks.
"Mr. Rapp," Flood looked up. "I assume it's all right that I call you by your real name?"
Rapp nodded.
"What's your poison?"
"Bourbon. Booker's, please." Flood glanced up from his bartending duties with a raised eyebrow. Rapp wasn't sure if the general was impressed or thought him crazy. Flood finished with the drinks and brought them over to the group, saying,
"As I was saying, Mr. Rapp, you really got their attention in there. Dallas King, Vice President Baxter's chief of staff, came up to me after the meeting and wanted to know who in the hell you were."
Flood handed Kennedy her drink.
"Here you go, Irene."
"And?" asked Rapp.
"And?" Flood snorted. "I told him he needed to get a higher security clearance if he wanted to discuss such matters. I could hardly tell him you were an analyst after your little performance."
Flood finished delivering the drinks and took the chair opposite Rapp at the long end of the coffee table. Kennedy and Stansfield were seated on one couch, and General Campbell faced them on the other. Rapp looked to his bosses and said,
"I'm sorry if I was out of line, but I've come too far to watch a bunch of hacks screw this up."
The director of the CIA held his glass of scotch with both hands. After a moment, he nodded his head slowly and said,
"I would have preferred you to have kept quiet, but you did say some things that needed to be said."
Stansfield took a sip and then added,
"And in a way that none of us could have."
General Flood nodded in agreement.
"And more importantly, you have made it very clear what's at stake. Right now, Baxter has put all of his chips behind Marge Tutwiler, and thanks to your blunt critique of her game plan, her position is fully exposed. If her strategy backfires tomorrow, Baxter will drop her in a heartbeat and he will have to listen to us."
Rapp sat back. "So we sit around and wait for this to blow up in Tutwiler's face?"
"Nope."
General Flood shook his head.
"I never like to sit around and wait. There are always preparations to be made before one goes into battle."
Flood shifted his ample frame and placed his drink on the end table to his right.
"The four of us here,"
Flood motioned to Kennedy, Stansfield, Campbell, and himself,
"are in agreement that in all likelihood there is only one way this crisis will be resolved. We will have to retake the building by force. Aziz will string Vice President Baxter along until we're in an untenable situation, a situation where we cannot and should not meet his demands. When that time comes, we have to be in a position to move, and as I said before, I don't like sending men into battle unless I'm prepared."
Flood paused and took a sip of scotch.
"Now, you people are in the intelligence gathering business,"
Flood gestured to Stansfield, Kennedy, and Rapp.
"So I don't have to explain to you that a battle plan without good intel is iffy at best. So the bottom line is we need real hard intel, and we need it now."
Leaning back, Flood crossed his legs.
"Someone has to get inside."
Looking at Rapp, Flood added,
"We need a volunteer. Someone who is willing to take some risks. Someone who understands Rafik Aziz. Someone with unique talents such as yours, Mr. Rapp."
The general's words felt like warm sunshine after a cold swim. Rapp couldn't keep himself from grinning. With confidence, he replied,
"I'm your man."
Flood smiled.
"I thought so."
Then turning to the director of the CIA, Flood asked,
"Thomas?"
Stansfield thought about it for a second and nodded.
"I think it's a good idea, but it might be tough getting approval for it. The FBI won't like it."
"I could give a damn," growled the general. "This is war, and in war we fight by a different set of rules." "Now, I like Brian Roach," said Flood, referring to the director of the FBI, "but he needs to understand that we cannot afford to play by one set of rules while Aziz plays by another. We need our A team on the front line, not the junior varsity. And," Flood pointed to Rapp, "Mitch here is the A team."
Flood took a sip of his drink, and then leaning forward, he placed his big hand on Stansfield's shoulder.
"You find a way to get him in, and I'll make sure we get approval."
Stansfield thought a moment, and then nodded his head in agreement. General Flood withdrew his hand and sat back. Looking around the room, he asked,
"Now, does anybody have any ideas on how we're going to get him in?"
After a while, Stansfield said,
"No, but I have a good idea where to start."
The sun was setting as Vice President Baxter left the Pentagon. Attorney General Tutwiler had gone back to the Hoover Building with FBI Director Roach and Special Agent McMahon. Baxter sat alone with Dallas King in the back seat of the armor-plated limousine. The vice president looked languidly out the window as Dallas King babbled on about what should be covered when Baxter addressed the nation, a move they had decided was both necessary and an opportunity that couldn't be missed. Baxter would be guaranteed the largest audience in the history of presidential addresses. The only question for King right now was whether they should do a scripted address, with Baxter reading from a teleprompter, or hold a more natural and impromptu press conference. Baxter was only half listening to his subordinate. King was rambling on about focus groups and polling data, while the vice president's mind kept drifting back to the dark-featured gentleman from the CIA, the terrorism specialist, Baxter reminded himself. Baxter held his hand up and motioned for King to be silent. The vice president let his well-manicured fingers fall to his knee while he struggled to pin down what exactly it was that was bothering him. After a moment, he pursed his lips and said,
"Call our contacts over at the National Security Agency and see what you can find out about that Mr. Cruz fellow."
"I'm already on it," replied King as he typed a note into his palm-top computer.
"Find out what he really does for the CIA.
Baxter looked out the window again.
"If he's right, and we have to take the building back by force."
Baxter shook his head. King looked up from his computer and said, "We will lose hostages, and the American people will never vote for a trigger-happy presidential candidate that ordered the death of 76 Americans." Baxter added an eye roll to his head shaking.
"This no longer appears to be the opportunity that you originally thought."
King closed his palm top and placed it in the breast pocket of his suit coat. "I never said it was going to be easy. With this much on the line, it's never easy. The trick, as always, will be to navigate our way through the minefield."
"There may not be a path through this particular one," Baxter sighed.
"I haven't come across a minefield yet that I couldn't get through," King flashed his confident grin. "Your job is to sit back and let everybody else look for the mines. Tomorrow, for instance, we let Marge take the lead on this negotiation angle. If it works, we're all one big happy family. If it doesn't, she takes the fall all on her own."
"What if we have to storm the place and we lose 30, 40, hell, maybe all of the hostages?" Baxter pointed at himself. "I'm the only one who can order that. You said it yourself. The American people will never vote for a president who has the slaughter of that many hostages hanging around his neck."
Baxter shook his head.
"Shit, I just thought of something else. What if I order the assault and it doesn't work? What if the nation sits down for dinner and they're treated to footage of FBI agents getting killed while trying to storm the White House? My career would be over, and yours too."
Baxter's defeatist head-shaking continued, and with gritted teeth he added,
"We're screwed almost any way you look at this thing."
"Not true," replied King. "If we pull this off, you'll be a hero." King pointed at his boss. "You'll be the next president of the United States of America. We just need to play our cards very carefully, and we need to start with Director Tracy. We miscalculated how he would handle your public reprimand. We can't have him holding a press conference tomorrow. If he reads the comments you made when you were campaigning, it would make us look like shit. I think I should go see him. Offer him the olive branch and tell him we want him to stay in charge of the Secret Service and help the FBI. I'll tell him it was Tutwiler's idea to can him, and you went along with it because you were so upset about the attack. I'll tell him you weren't thinking clearly and that you're grateful for the service he has given this country, yada, 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 you know the gig. I'll stroke him." Baxter thought about it for a second, and with a tired sigh said,
"Go ahead, do whatever it takes to keep him quiet."
Chapter 13 The White House was silent as the clock approached midnight. Aziz left the Situation Room and walked down the hall to horsepower. The door was open, and Aziz entered without knocking. Sitting in a swivel chair, Benghazi was keeping an idea on a bank of black and white security monitors. The monitors showed different areas of the grounds around the White House and shots of all the main entrances. Normally, the system also kept an eye on areas within the White House, but Benghazi had disabled the cameras for fear that the FBI might find some way to pirate the images and spy on them. Aziz placed his hand on the back of the chair and asked,
"How does everything look?"
"Nice and quiet."
"Good. Have you been getting sleep?"
"Yes."
"How about the men?"
"They are doing fine."
"And the hostages?"
"Asleep."
As Aziz looked at the monitors, the walkie-talkie on his hip squawked and his name barked forth. Bringing it to his mouth, he said,
"Yes?"
"Rafik, I have made progress. I think you should come see."
"I'll be right down."
Aziz had been not so patiently waiting for this update. Having succeeded beyond all of his people's wildest dreams, he was still not content, and would not be until he wrestled the cowardly president from his bunker. He held the White House hostage, and the entire government of the United States had come to a grinding halt, but that wasn't enough. Aziz reached the third basement and headed for the bunker. When he rounded the corner, he found his man sitting on a toolbox, drenched in sweat and smoking a cigarette. The short, fat man looked up with a large grin, his nicotine-stained teeth topped by a pointy nose and a graying mustache. Goggles hung from his neck, and a pair of orange ear protectors were perched atop his head, giving him the appearance of a plump rodent. The man placed his large and thick horn-rimmed glasses back on his face and waved toward the outer door to the bunker with a smile.
"Open sesame!"
Aziz stepped forward and pushed on the steel door. It swung inward, revealing a room and a shiny vault-like door at the other end. A rush of emotion swept over him as he thought of the president and his bodyguard sitting on the other side of the door thinking they were safe. Aziz walked slowly across the concrete floor and stopped just in front of the vault door. Extending his hand, he placed his palm flat on the smooth surface. Clenching his fist, Aziz hammered on the door twice. No sound reverberated. Spinning away from the door, Aziz looked at the last-minute addition to his cause. The frumpy man before him was a gift from Aziz's newest benefactor, a man who had a very personal stake in how Aziz's mission turned out. The slovenly safecracker standing in the doorway had come complete with his own tools and unique talent. As it was explained to Aziz, the door that was installed on the president's bunker was of the same type that the U.S. military used for all of their command and control bunkers and was designed to withstand large blasts, not drills and acetylene blowtorches. Aziz looked at the man and asked,
"How long will this door take?"
The safecracker exhaled a cloud of smoke and said,
"If I push it and risk burning out one of the drills, I could probably have it open in 30 hours.
"What happens if you lose one of the drills?"
"Then we are in trouble,"
the little thief shrugged.
"It could end up taking 3 or 4 days.
"And if you play it safe?"
"I can have it open in 48 hours.
Aziz put his hands in a prayerful grip and bounced them off his chin twice.
48 hours will suffice. And with a wave of his finger, he cautioned, "But no longer than that."
Aziz walked past him and slapped him on the shoulder.
"Good work, Mustafa."
Aziz left the room, leaving his little thief to retrieve the crown jewel. As he walked down the hallway, he thought, "All I have to do is keep them at bay for 2 more days. The lights were off in the bunker, and everyone was trying to get some sleep. Warch was lying on the bunk closest to the door. The Secret Service agent was wide awake. He could hear President Hayes snoring at the far end of the room, and every minute or so squeaking springs could be heard as someone turned on the narrow beds. Warch wondered how his wife and children were doing. His family would be afraid, but that couldn't be helped. Being married to someone who was trained to throw himself in front of an oncoming bullet was a little nerve-wracking, but Sarah was strong. She would have the kids to keep her busy, and her parents were in Baltimore. The service would tell her and the kids that he was all right. Warch's thoughts turned to the other wives and husbands that weren't as fortunate. Over and over again, Warch had replayed the frantic radio traffic that had barked out over his earpiece while they rushed the president to the bunker. Agents down, agents down. And then there was the explosion and the machine gun fire. And now, over 12 hours later, nothing. Everything added up to one conclusion. Aziz and his terrorists were in control of the White House. Warch ran down a list of the faces and names of his agents who were on the day shift. He couldn't help but wonder which ones had made it out alive and which ones were dead. Still, despite what was undoubtedly the worst day in the history of the Secret Service, they had at least saved the president from the talons of Aziz. Warch savored that one accomplishment as he felt sleep coming on. He rolled toward the wall and let out a yawn. When most of the air was expelled from his lungs, he froze. Warch had not heard the noise before. He was sure of that. Craning his neck toward the door, he tried to listen. It was a clanging noise, metal on metal. There were several more clanging noises, and then a low whine, almost like an electric razor. Warch listened for another moment and then sprang out of bed, throwing his blankets to the side. The concrete floor felt cold to his feet. In his white t-shirt and boxers, he knelt on the floor and pressed his left ear to the door, and then it hit him. It was a drill. They were drilling through the vault door, which meant they had already broken through the outer door. Warch's palms became sweaty on the cool metallic surface, and he swore out loud. Standing, he turned on the light and said to the room at large, "Wake up, people. We have trouble." Chapter 14. A faint, methodical beep could be heard in the distance. Rapp felt as if he were swimming upward for it, out of a deep black hole. The noise became more pronounced with each kick and downward stroke. It was getting lighter. He was nearing the surface. Suddenly, Rapp sat up in bed, his thick black hair sticking out in Medusa-like fashion. It took him a second to realize he'd been dreaming. It was the same damn dream he'd been having for as long as he could remember. Drowning. It was always drowning. He was always swimming for the surface, gasping for air. Several shakes of the head later, Rapp realized where he was. The faint, gray light of early morning was spilling through his bedroom windows. He turned to make out the red digital numerals of his alarm clock. There was a 4, followed by another, and then a 5. God, it was nice to be home, Rapp thought. Without looking, he reached over and swatted the snooze button. Then he flopped backward onto the crisp white sheets and stretched out, kicking the blankets to the side. Not quite ready to get out of bed, he allowed his mind to drift. Outside the bedroom window, he could hear the gentle waves of the Chesapeake lapping against the rocky shore. They were calling his name, tugging at him to get out of bed. Rapp turned diagonally across the queen-size bed and stretched his arms way above his head, letting out a drawn-out yawn. He had forced himself to go home and sleep after a meeting at Director Tracy's house. There was nothing else to do. Dr. Hornig had promised a full report on the results of their interrogation with Farah Harout in the morning, and until then it was a waiting game, something Rapp wasn't very good at. Now, as he rolled onto his side, he suddenly remembered the events of the day before and of the little crisis that was taking place 30-some miles to the west. A small voice in the back of his head screamed something, and Rapp was on his feet instantly. Naked, he walked across the hardwood floor of his bedroom and stopped in front of a set of French doors. They were open, and through the screens he could now hear bird songs filling the still morning air. Across the bay, on the tree-lined horizon, the sky was brightening. The sun was coming up over the Atlantic, and a memorable day was about to begin, whether he liked it or not. The lapping water continued to call his name, and with more enthusiasm than any sane person would have had, Rapp turned and headed across the worn and creaky wood floor of his beach house. Once he'd finished negotiating the precipitous staircase that led down to the main floor, he walked to the kitchen and then the mudroom. Hanging on a brass hook by the back door was a faded, salt-stained blue swimsuit that looked as old as its owner. Rapp put the worn trunks on, grabbed his goggles and towel, and headed out the back door. The thermometer on the deck railing told him it was a comfortable 62 degrees, just cool enough to wake him up, but not so cold as to dash his enthusiasm. With several shakes of his arms, he continued across the brand-new deck to the stairs that led down to the water. Rapp had bought the house the previous year, and his only home improvement to date was to tear down the rotted wood deck and stairs and replace them. After a 30-foot descent, he put on his goggles and picked up the pace. Rapp ran across the long, flat section of dock that jutted out into the water. On the right was a 24-foot Boston Whaler, and at the end of the dock was a bench that sat atop an 8-foot section that turned at a 90-degree angle to the left. By the time Rapp reached the bench, he was at a full jog. Without breaking stride, he tossed the towel onto the bench and dove into the salty water. He found his rhythm within 6 or 7 strokes and settled in for the 1-mile swim up the coast. Rapp no longer competed professionally, but just 3 years earlier he had been one of the world's top-ranked triathletes. In the Mount Everest of triathlon competitions, the Ironman in Hawaii, Rapp had posted 3 top-5 finishes and a first place. But his work with the CIA had picked up considerably in the last 5 years, and the hectic and unpredictable schedule had forced him to give up competition. Rapp returned to the dock in front of his house at 5:40, feeling fresh and loose. After toweling off, he made it back up to the house and into the shower. 15 minutes later, he was shaved, dressed, and out the door, with a cup of piping hot coffee in his hand. Rapp slid behind the wheel of his new black Volvo sedan and eased it out of the narrow garage. He took it slow as he drove down his crumbling asphalt driveway. That was another project he would have to tackle before winter came. When he reached a sturdier surface, he increased speed and began to enjoy the performance of the new sedan. It felt good to be back in civilization. Several minutes later, he was on Route 50 and on his way to a meeting at Langley. Dr. Hornig was to give a briefing at 7 a.m. on everything she had learned from her session with Farah Harout. Rapp was not overly excited about sharing breakfast with Dr. Strangelove, but considering the information she would provide, he was willing to bite the bullet. 22 minutes later, Rapp caught the beltway and took it around the northern part of D.C. Traffic was picking up, but at this early hour it still moved along at a brisk 10 miles per hour over the posted speed limit. 15 minutes after reaching the beltway, Rapp pulled through the first security checkpoint at Langley and parked his car. After passing through the main security checkpoint of the old building, Rapp took the elevator to Director Stansfield's office on the 7th floor. Stansfield's administrative assistant reported his arrival over her headset, and a moment later, Irene Kennedy appeared. Kennedy escorted Rapp into the director's inner sanctum, where the man himself was seated behind his large desk, a pair of bifocals perched at the edge of his nose, his attention focused on an open file. Stansfield took another moment to finish, and then closed the file. Before standing, he grabbed a stack of documents, opened one of the drawers behind his desk, inserted them, closed the door, and locked it with a key. Stansfield left his suit coat hanging on the coat rack and came around the desk, pulling up his suit pants another notch.
"Good morning, Mitch. I hope you got some sleep last night."
"I did, sir. And you?" Stansfield placed his fragile hand on Rapp's shoulder. The DCI was almost a full head shorter than Rapp.
"When you get to my age, Mitch, sleep becomes a very elusive thing.
Sansfield turned his young specialist away from his desk and started walking him across the office.
I've set up a meeting for you this morning, but we'll talk about that later. Dr. Hornig is waiting for us, and I'd like to hear what she's found out before we get into anything else.
As Rapp followed Stansfield and Kennedy through a door and into a windowless conference